From my closet in London, this is the Working On It podcast. I'm Antonio Pavlovich. Like many other things that make a space function, things like light, temperature, or sound, for example, wayfinding is unnoticeable until you realize that it doesn't work. Today's guest wants her wayfinding designs to be rather invisible. Lucy Holmes is a problem solver who uses graphic design and her understanding of behavior to almost inconspicuously navigate people through spaces, which include very famous landmarks like the Tate Modern, the Whitechapel Gallery, the V&A, and many others. There are not many designers who have literally carved their work into the walls of the National Gallery in London like Lucy has. So here is a conversation with Lucy Holmes.
Oh, I'm gonna turn my cuckoo clock.
We just wait for it, don't worry.
Well, it might come back on again at 12.
That's fine.
Let me just hold on. I think it'll be off. Yeah, that's fine.
Is that an actual cuckoo clock, like the old fashioned one, or?
Well, it is, but it's I don't know if you've seen them, but Muji did a really sweet cuckoo clock,
and it's, I haven't seen that.
They're sort of, mine's white, and a little cuckoo pops out, which I quite like.
Fantastic,
and I've given them to different friends and family, so quite often when I'm talking to friends, I can hear all our cuckoos are ringing, which is quite nice. But
yeah, thank you for taking the time. Thank you to speak to me on the podcast. And I was thinking this morning when I was sort of slightly prepping for this, and I'm not a particularly nervous person, but I am nervous to talk to you, and I'll tell you why. Is that I've looked into your work, obviously, and the work that you're doing currently and the work that you've done with Holmes Wood. It's exactly the sort of design and the sort of work that I, when I was in design, aspired to be doing, and that I would literally use for inspiration. So to be able to talk to you, and I'm not trying to sort of be overly nice or anything, but it's just, I really like the way it seems to me that you approach your design work. I love the detail. I love how it works in the built environment and everything. So that is what it makes me a bit sort of nervous to talk to you.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm always nervous. So firstly, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. And I mean, obviously we've met through Paul Hanegraaff, who, yep. I was listening to your podcast with him this morning. It's so funny because we hardly ever talk about design or what we do. As far as I see it, I'm a problem solver or a problem interrogator, and I get great pleasure from it. And I think the body of work that we produced at Holmes Wood was, you know, a completely combined team experience and contribution, and we had a really great time, you know, doing it. And I think, but it's, you don't ever sort of sit back that often and think about what you did. You just, a bit like today, you just keep doing it, don't you? And hopefully people will keep asking.
Have you ever sat back? Do you know that feeling that, I'm comparing it to my own, obviously. Have you ever had that feeling that you look back at something that you've done years back and think, oh my God, really?
Oh, well, everything, it's absolutely over and over and over again. But what I do think, because so much of work that I have done with the team ended up in the built environment, it's a very different kind of design than producing a paper-based piece of print, because there are so many more stakeholders involved. So actually, there's so much discussion before around what one is trying to achieve, and discussion around the impact of spending X amount of money on something that is going to go, you know, into a physical space, and quite often has to last for 10, 20 plus years. I've really enjoyed the fact that you know, the conversation and around and the thinking before one even starts to approach the concept of doing a piece of design. It's a more collaborative process for me than when I'm designing a brochure, which I still do. So I think there are certain things you think. I mean, I look at something, you know, for example, I am really proud of the fact that we carved into the top of the National Gallery in gold leaf, incised lettering, and then gold leaf. You know, I am really proud of that. But whenever I go past Trafalgar Square, I also remember that it took us 4 years of negotiation and discussion, and because we were going to carve into, you know, an incredibly historic, important building in the centre of London. So I think I often remember, if I look at something and I think, oh God, along with that comes all of the conversations around how it ended up looking that way. Yeah. Or, you know, and the compromise potentially that we had to deal with.
Just for the people listening to us, how would you describe what you do?
Well, at the basic level, I'm a graphic designer, and I went through the traditional 4 years of kind of, I guess, craftsman type training. And I think as a graphic designer, if you then pick that apart, we are communicators. We take, you know, I'm not an artist. A blank piece of paper is not a friendly place for me without anything someone's asked me to do something. I don't enjoy, I really enjoy a brief and a challenge. So I think on the craftsmanship level, I've been taught by people to understand color and typography and composition, etc. How that then goes into professional practice is around the kind of intellectual conversation, the brief, an interrogation of a brief. So I guess I'm a communicator, I'm a problem solver, I'm a storyteller probably, and I think everyone's talking about storytelling. But when you work in the built environment, you are trying to enable people to move around easily without feeling like they're being sort of shouted at by signs or confused by architecture or floor finishes or whatever it is. So I think it's a journey maker. I don't know. I was interested in hearing again Paul talking about his title of being a creative navigator. And I remember that when I first heard it, and I was like, that's pretty cool. But yeah, I'm basically a graphic designer. And then with that comes, you know, the professional kind of manifestation of it.
Yeah, like problem solver, and it speaks to me personally because that's the way I always describe design and design work. I trained to be an industrial designer and then sort of taught myself graphic design by doing things, and it is. And this is where it is problem solving, and this is where the brief actually is very important. Like you said, if you're an artist, you can work on a blank sheet of paper. That terrifies me personally. I need to understand what kind of problem I'm actually trying to solve, and it can be anything. It can be from the industrial design side, of course, but it can also be just when you mentioned a brochure. It can also be in the most simple way that the layout actually fits, the content actually fits the layout, and vice versa. That's sort of the most basic problem solving. But it all goes up to the way you communicate from that thing, from the brochure, what it does, how does it make people feel, and everything else.
Yeah, and I think, to solve a problem, you have to really understand what the problem is. And that's usually, where if you win a project around, the tender process or whatever, those first meetings where you actually sit down and you have clients who are open to a conversation and a kind of become a collaborative discussion, often that the problem actually isn't what we thought it was, or it is what we thought it was, but it's not quite what we thought it was. And I think that's the most important part of the process, because there's some simple levels. If we're all talking about the problem sort of together, inevitably we own what that problem is and the problem that we're trying to solve, and we own it together. And for me, that then enables a much more collaborative design process, because by those early conversations, sometimes can be quite challenging, and sometimes they can feel like you're talking more than you should be, and it's just get on with it. But actually what happens is, because you keep talking around the problem, you sort of, it starts to solve itself. And because I think, I'm trying to think of an example of there was a museum that we were working in once, and we kept going along to meetings, and it was the project team, and part of, we would all have our sort of time slot. And one of the conversations was around the design of the desk in this entrance by these architects. And what was interesting is we kept talking about the design of the desk, and it never got settled. And in the end, what we realized, and it was something that Alex Wood and I suggested, is maybe this isn't the right place for a desk. And in the end, the desk was moved to somewhere else completely in the museum. And I think sometimes it is, if something's a bit stuck, it's usually because it isn't quite right. And if everybody's brave enough and open enough to talk about it, then collectively I think you get, things move in the right direction. And there's a subtlety to designing for the built environment, particularly in a museum and gallery. And if you think about human emotion and time, if you're in an airport, your human emotion and your sense of time is very different to if you're on a Sunday afternoon going to a gallery. And you have to factor in time and that kind of humanity into the work you do. If you work, if your main challenge is to move people around a space, whether it's get them on an aeroplane or help them find the cafe or the cloakroom or an exhibition in a museum.
Has most of your work been related to museums, and how did you end up, how did you go from studying design and then being working for well, quite impressive museums, actually, honestly?
My first job out of college was at Pentagram in London. Mm. And I worked for David Hillman, who's at that point, main clients were The Guardian and Tate Gallery. This is before the other three Tates. So this is in the early 90s. And one of the projects that I was involved in on a day-to-day basis was Tate Gallery. So we were designing an identity for the opening of Tate Liverpool and then Tate St Ives. And when I left after sort of 4 years of at Pentagram to set up my own studio, David unbelievably generously let me take some of the Tate work with me. So the day-to-day, the events leaflet, the posters for buses, the t-shirts for the shop. And I carried on, and that sort of helped me launch my own studio. And then that grew, and it grew, Tate grew for me into something bigger, which ended up being at the point at which Wolf Olins were designing a new identity for Tate Modern, and well, all of Tate's, but it was going to be launched, it's actually 20 years ago now, for the opening of Tate Modern. I was then involved on the sort of Tate side as taking forward some of that brand identity work and introducing it into the built environment. So the first project, and at the point at which I met Alex Wood, we were introducing the brand identity into that power station that had never had people in it. And at that point, I think, well, we started working in probably 2 years before opening, we started working on plans with Herzog & de Meuron and Wolf Olins and the rest of the project team. And it was the first time, I think there was a schedule that said, well, signs, yep, well, we've allowed, there are this many loos, so that's a start. There'll be a sign on each door, and then the rest of it will, it'll sort of figure itself out. And actually, we came at it with our combined experience and said, well, hang on a minute, why don't we think about the people who are going to be in this place, and if they've come in this entrance or that entrance, or what they want to see, or are they a family or whatever, or a group or an individual or a foreign non-English speaking person. And we were part of that team that launched Tate Modern opening, and we were lucky. It was, for everybody, it was a successful project. It was on budget, on time, and it was fabulous. And so it grew because we started writing articles about sort of articulating wayfinding and people and place. And we then unbelievably were winning other museums, and you know, they were the V&A, the National Gallery, Arnolfini, Baltic, etc. But one of the things that was quite funny about that was we were selling an idea, I suppose, that our work had a long lifespan. And we then figured out that actually we were doing ourselves out of a job, because if we were designing everything that was going to have a long lifespan and we ran out of galleries, you know, what were we going to do? So we then, you know, we did that for a period of time. And we then kind of thought, well, actually, if we can apply people, place, architecture, we can look at different areas. And we then took those skills and we were targeting different types of spaces. So we've done some work with universities, and that was a very interesting moment because that happened at the point of which students were fee paying in this country, and therefore there was a psychological shift in their thinking that they were slightly more choosing the university, rather than previously in the UK it had always been the university choosing you. And a lot of universities embarked on big capital projects to create new facilities, which meant new buildings, which meant wayfinding. And so, yeah, I think wherever you have it, so it started in, it was rooted in museums and galleries, which I actually think are the most challenging places, because you're competing with beautiful objects or paintings or sculpture or whatever it is. And actually the success of a wayfinding scheme in a museum for me is that nobody really notices it, but it's there. And people can find their way around, but it's quite light touch. It's sort of intuitive. It's enabling. It's gentle. But when you do have to get somewhere, somewhere, then you can do it where, you know, if you need to identify the entrance to a lecture theatre in a more dramatic way, then absolutely, because ultimately you've got, you know, these museums have multiple facilities. But when you're designing, when we did the wayfinding for the V&A, it was all about being as respectful for objects. And so what we did was we worked very closely with the project team and the curators, and we were able to move objects so you could see sculpture, so we didn't have to say sculpture, which meant we didn't need signs, or we could actually evaluate the lux levels and we could change light levels in the spaces. And so there were actually far fewer. I think we put back in, when we took out the signs in the V&A in the early 2000s and we installed the scheme that we put in, it was something like a third of the signs that were had been in before we put back, because you just didn't need them. And but that only worked with a really fantastic map and a fantastic group of museum staff who we consulted with throughout the whole process.
I just wanted to jump on what you said, that it's almost invisible, the work that you do in museums. But I think, and tell me if you agree, that actually in any space, commercial space, museums, airports, anything, you notice bad wayfinding, but you don't see the good one. You don't really notice the good wayfinding, because you only notice bad wayfinding because it doesn't work.
That's absolutely, I totally agree. And I think it's the success. I can use an example, actually. I was asked a number of years ago as part of the Sorrell Foundation and their Saturday clubs. Can't remember exactly what they, I think they're called Saturday Club or Saturday School. And I was asked as part of this to participate, and it was going to be at the V&A. And I was given, I think, 8 people, and I had to sort of work with them in some way for a few hours. And I thought, well, this would be really interesting to see if I can meet them in certain places in the V&A, but they have to find me. And so I put them into pairs, and for each group, I gave them a sketchbook and some colored pencils. And then I wrote a narrative of the objects that I wanted them to see before they would then meet me again. And so I was, you know, exposing our work absolutely, and hoping I would see them again. Anyway, I went and sat in the furniture gallery, which at that point was quite new. And at the allotted time, everybody started to arrive. So everybody found their way and they arrived and we were chatting, and I said, well, could we have a conversation about your experience? And what was great was everyone was talking about objects and the collection and a sculpture they had seen or a gallery they had not visited before. And I said, so can I just ask, did you find the signs helpful? And the first person said, well, there aren't any signs. Which I thought, well, that was great. And then someone else said, well, I've done a drawing of my journey and I didn't notice any signs either. And anyway, she had used the colored pencils, and every time she changed color, it was the color that was used on the sign scheme for that area of the building, but she hadn't noticed, which I thought was a good outcome. But it is, it's what you're trying to do is design invisibly, design intuitively. And, you know, we ended up calling this within Holmes Wood, we used to call it that we wanted you to feel comfortably lost in a museum. And we made a film about it, actually. And it was the idea that our collective philosophy was this notion that if you have been given the tools and you are enabled to take control of your own museum experience, then you will enjoy and roam and dwell and kick back and relax and sit and look at a sculpture because you feel comfortable, because your time is your own and you can, you're in command of your own sort of destiny. And I think when people are in a space and they can't find the cloakroom and they're late for the exhibition because they didn't find it, that's just, we failed. And I think the aim with these sorts of things is to make sure that that doesn't happen. I think it is about being invisible. But then, you know, there are other times where you have to make a statement because there are certain architectural, you know, interventions, or there are sight lines that are challenging. And that's where scale or colour or something else might come into the mix.
And I would also say that the same logic actually applies to commercial environments like, you know, shopping centres or offices as well. You only notice as a shopper, and obviously a shopping centre is a much more noisy and busy environment and rushed environment compared to a museum. But as a visitor, you only notice that there's the bad wayfinding because you are either lost or you can't find something that you were looking for, store, toilets, anything. And that's a disaster actually for landlords, because the last thing they want is for people to leave because they couldn't find something.
Yeah, and there's a similar psychology, actually. You know, there's an element of retailers wanting people to be a little bit lost so that they don't leave as quickly. And they might, is it down here? Oh, look, there's another shop I might pop into. I have done some work in retail, and particularly actually with Paul Hanegraaff, we worked on a project in Birmingham. And, you know, that was all about a very, very open dialogue and intent collectively between the architects, between us and the client, to create a place that was going to be really different. And it wasn't, you know, it was a long, thin building over three levels, but it had a lot of complexity. But we ended up with a very, very simple solution, only because I think we had a very brave client who was, you know, we were doing something that wasn't necessarily entirely conventional. We used quite traditional language. We had quite a light touch. So, for example, at an escalator, yes, there are 100 things we could have said what was upstairs, but we just went up to 2 and 3. And it kind of had a statement of, you know, the tone of voice was confidence. And people just went up the escalator because they knew that when they got to a point where they would need something, we were going to give it to them, because we were gently pulling them up the vertical circulation. And the floor directory that enabled you for a sort of greater amount of information was a little bit further away. So we only had to have one, and it could deal with, you know, they were on particular axes in the space. And there was an extensive list, but there was a lot to say, so that could be quite small. And we didn't have to kind of shout about, you know, what was everywhere. So we tried to create a feeling, you know, between myself, Paul, and the marketing team of just relax. You'll find it. Don't worry. You'll find it. And, you know, that started from, you know, the conversations around the kind of curation of the music in the car park, and you know, and everything was thought about, but I think it worked because we really did interrogate and rigorously go through customer experience, customer journey, the kind of attitude we wanted to create in the mailbox.
And becomes more of a wayfinding than advertising.
Yeah, I think you have to, you know, one of the things that we did was they had this advertising line. So basically, this building was going to be semi-open, partly closed, and being, because it was being redeveloped. So it was really challenging. And one of the big things was, at a certain point and for quite a long time, the known main entrance for people in Birmingham was going to close, but the marketing line was still open, still luxurious. So we worked really hard to try to come up with a way to make sure that people didn't think it was closed and closed down, that there was something exciting happening, and we were kind of managing expectation. And in the end, we built a new front door under the motorway. We got planning permission. So under the underpass, we built this enormous red door that was open, and it was ajar. So the door that was ajar, as you walked through, we placed it so that you actually walked straight past without seeing it, the old front door. And we then just gently pushed people up a side street. And then instead of any signs outside what was normally a very sort of secondary entrance, we built a 6-meter lamp.
Oh, yeah.
And it pointed towards the door, and it had a light in it. And, you know, it wasn't about hoardings and it wasn't about signs. There weren't any signs. But what happened was everyone was Instagramming themselves by the red lamp and saying there's something really cool happening at the mailbox. And actually, the lamp is still there, I believe, however many years on. It's sort of become a landmark.
Yeah, and I know the place. The first time I heard of the place was because of the lamp.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I know exactly. I've never been, but I know it from pictures. I know exactly how it looks like, yeah.
And that was, you know, a really brave client who took a leap of faith with an idea we had. And we did it. And, you know, that's what's so great about, like, that, you know, that what I was going back to, that sort of conversation at the beginning, because our brief was, could you do some hoarding graphics? And we took it away and thought, well, that isn't really going to work, and that isn't really what these guys are about, and maybe we could be a bit braver. And, you know, that's what happened.
But talking about a briefing, when you get a brief from a client for a museum or commercial property or retail, when you start designing, are you designing for the client, or are you actually designing for the people who are going to be visiting the place?
Good question. I think always for a balance. So it's on the one hand, it's understanding the client and who they are and what their aspirations are. And it might be, you know, obviously it's about revenue. But it's also about encouraging repeat visits and loyalty, and you want people to visit and leave and want to come back. It's usually never a one-off visit, or not always. And then you are thinking about the people who are going to use it. So it's a complete balance between, and I think that's why at the kickoff of a process, which we would sort of call, you know, familiarization, it was about stakeholder conversations and spending, you know, long days with different people, be it visitors, be it the marketing department, the development department, the retail guys, the director, and listening to them one-on-one, never in a group if we can, and listening to what this project is for them. And then we have to digest all of that and try to come back with a strategic approach that ticks the boxes for as much as we possibly can. And, you know, there can be, obviously there's compromise, but what you're trying to do is, somebody who's selling event space and needs certain requirements versus someone who's dealing with learning, who has completely different requirements. As long as we really understand or from a functionality point of view and a practical point of view, what they need this to do, then we take that into account. And that becomes one of the biggest parts of what we do at the beginning of a project, and how I feel is it's really helpful, is there's quite an intellectual strategic proposal, which is separate from the creative. And so what we're doing is, strategically, we are agreeing that this approach, this set of signs, this kind of language, these kinds of touch points and elements are the right ones to solve the problem without being distracted by what it looks like. So we try to get the strategic approach agreed, and then we look at the creative based on that, so that we're not judging for the wrong. So if someone likes a particular material, but it's actually a slightly different solution, they're not, it's not muddled up into one thing. That makes sense.
Yeah, and the whole strategic part also helps you with the more sort of simple discussions around, you know, I've been in the situation where people will look at something that myself or my team worked on, and they will say, well, I love it, but I don't like color purple. So it gets you, well, then you have to explain that actually, if there is a strategy, there's thinking behind it, then all of a sudden this color purple that this person hates makes sense. And it's not about personal preferences. It's always something that I found, certainly when I was beginning in design, the most challenging part of dealing with internal or external clients.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, color is a really, really challenging factor, because on the one hand, you know, when you've got a sort of marketing strategy or a brand that is predominantly potentially about, you know, the outside look of a place, imposing those colors into an architecture and interior design is usually not necessarily right, because what the designers of the brand have been tasked to do is certainly probably not what one wants a visitor to experience, and how you want them to, at a rudimentary level, find an exit. So color is a really challenging element that sometimes, you know, we have had to use a color in signs within architecture that, frankly, we would rather not have done. And actually, you know, what we're trying to do is to make the signs and the architecture and the space connect and be integrated. You know, so putting a blue sign on a traditional sandstone building is, it just doesn't feel necessarily right. But sometimes a brand needs that, or the decision makers want that, so that there is this visibility. But yeah, its color is, I've definitely, and actually it's been purple, I've definitely had meetings. I had a meeting once where it was for an annual report, and we had three creative concepts, and it was the head of the chairman of the board, or chairman of the organization. And the first one we pulled out had a purple color. He said, I hate purple. And he walked out. So that's why I try to do gentle steps, so that if someone can hate one element, which you completely understand, it doesn't necessarily bomb out the whole meeting.
And also trying to let people understand that it's not specifically about their personal preferences, but it's about what works and the reasons why it works, being it color or shapes or, you know. I hate triangles. Yeah, I can't.
Yeah, but you know, if you think about, I mean, this is an interesting one actually, because we're in this pretty strange time in our lives. But one of the things that for me I have done is I've spent more time in the garden or walking in the countryside than I probably ever have in a 11-week period. And we've been blessed with incredible weather. And so nature's colour has been a complete privilege to experience over the last 2 or 3 months, particularly as spring has sort of woken up the landscape. And we can't replicate those colours in paint and in ink. And it's so interesting, you know, so often, particularly with the ability of CGIs and Photoshop, you know, you can show a client what something will look like in a purple, let's say, that we've created in Photoshop that pretty much matches the Pantone, but it's going to be stove enamel, aluminium, etc., etc. And, you know, and then you've got a piece of marketing, which is the Pantone process, and it's not RAL, it's, you know, and you put a sign next to a leaflet and oops, you know, they don't match, and it's not a surprise. And I think that's where there are some, you know, quite simple decisions quite often where, you know, take a hint from nature and let materials be their natural selves. So I'm a big supporter in, you know, glass and metals that can age with time, but they're durable. But you're not trying to necessarily transform them in ways that particularly if something's going to be in an environment for 10, 20 years, it's just not going to age well. And I think, you know, there are a lot of practical considerations that you learn working when you're working alongside manufacturing, that it's better not to push a material in the wrong direction, because it is natural. It'll behave the way it wants to behave. And, you know, I've quite often tried to bring wood together with a metal, and, you know, I'm rightly persuaded that one will swell and the other one won't. And it might look really lovely on day one, but, you know, further down the line, it's not. And I think that, you know, you learn about those sorts of things. You can't make something do what it's not meant to. And I also think in architecture, there's a reason why buildings aren't generally bright colours, because they're places that we visit every day and we don't need to have too much bright colour necessarily, unless it's a statement in itself. But, you know, we're trying to create a sort of harmonious environment, sort of blank canvas in a way. And I think that's part of the whole reason. That's the whole kind of thinking behind the sort of invisibility of things.
When it comes to wayfinding design and strategy, in my experience, and I'm not trying to downplay anybody's role or expertise, but in my experience, many architectural firms and design agencies, graphic design agencies, would if asked by a client, they would probably, most of them, say that they are able to do the wayfinding design as well, if they're already part of the or larger project. That's my experience. What makes your expertise, what makes the wayfinding design require different expertise than the architects or graphic designers have?
This is a conversation I've had often.
I'm not surprised. Hence the question.
Well, it's a really difficult one, because I think it's understanding what is wayfinding, and it isn't necessarily clear exactly what it is to a lot of people. And so, you know, some people call it wayfaring, and some people call it all sorts of signposting and signage. Signage is not a word I'm particularly in love with, but
no.
but it's I think you have to break it down into what does that mean, because I think to some people they would say that they do wayfinding because they took the brand elements that were on a piece of paper and they extended that family into putting something on a wall. And so what you end up with is you can see that the brand has evolved from being on a business card and a website, and it's now on the wall outside a building, and etc. And I think that isn't wayfinding. But I think quite often that's what happens. I think it's about someone's looked at a floor plan and thought, okay, the facilities in this building are X, so we're going to need these signs. I'm not going to judge whether I think that's best way of doing it. I would just say that we didn't come at it that way. We would spend not thinking about signs and not thinking about graphics or design. We would interrogate a space. So to go back to Tate Modern, you know, there wasn't a building that was in any shape that it, I mean, when we went into the turbine hall and it still had turbines in it in 1990, I think 4 or 5, I went in there, you couldn't imagine what Herzog and de Meuron were going to do. So for years, we had to work off paper plans, and this was pre-PDF and everything. So we were imagining our experience of walking down the ramp and walking into the turbine hall and what information we would need. And actually, that's quite a good example, because if you remember, you know, Tate Modern opened in May 2000. And I think a few days after the what was known as the Wobbly Bridge opened, it closed. And the connection, the vital connection, and that axis from Tate Modern to St. Paul's didn't exist for years. And that's how everybody was meant to arrive at Tate Modern. And the reality of the ramp entrance, because it's quite low where you actually go into the building. So the idea was that you go down the ramp and then into this incredible kind of cathedral space. But the glass was really reflective. So it looked like a black wall. So nobody was going in there. So everybody actually was going in a completely sort of secondary entrance by the cafe to the left of the ramp. And so we were having issues, and people were saying they can't find Tate Modern entrance. We were thinking, how could they not? And then you had to evaluate actually what was going on from a, you know, really day-to-day, hands-on, the main way that everyone was supposed to arrive at Tate Modern, and this whole area of London was going to open up, had failed because the bridge had failed. And was it 2 years before? I don't know. I can't remember how long it was, but it was a long time. So we were very quickly having to rethink how people would arrive at the space. So it's very practical. You have to get out there. You have to get your, you know, hard hat on and your tape measure out and walk around a space. And those are the things that actually enable you to design for effective wayfinding. And I think quite often graphic design that's called wayfinding has been done at a desk in a studio, not necessarily visiting the space or experiencing or feeling the scale of the building or what it actually looks like or where the sun shines or the sight lines. And, you know, so it's very practical, our approach. And I think that's what's worked, because we're dealing with real situations and real people and understanding sort of human reaction.
I'm not a particularly big fan of digital wayfinding, and that's putting it mildly. Ever since these digital platforms were starting to be introduced specifically in retail, in large retail properties, I've always had a problem with them. Either they wouldn't work, they were just dirty, something that you had to touch, which is obviously a really big problem now. And I've never actually understood why, what the benefit is of those digital tools over what I would call traditional wayfinding. Have you done any work on digital side of things?
Some work, not as much as I think you'd think I would have done. It's always in the brief, and it's always interrogated about whether it's the right thing. I agree with you. It's quite often not the right thing. And there then becomes this conflict between getting people off their phone and the physical space. So I think our phones, I mean, it's quite interesting with what we've been going through now, because, you know, I was one of those people who in London, people keep bumping into you because they're looking down at their phone. And of course, with social distancing, I mean, you know, we're all having to look up. And but that's a sort of a sideline. I think it's about understanding how you're trying to get people to move around a place. And I agree with you. I don't necessarily think digital is the right device. And, you know, I think it's, if you take the road sign, you know, if you're driving on a motorway, majority of the time, in my experience, the digital signs are not actually factually correct at the time you see them. They're usually telling you about something that's either not happening or hasn't, or happened a while ago. And so I don't think we, certainly for me, I don't necessarily trust digital signs on a road, whereas I do trust the blue and white or the whatever colored, you know, signs. And they are, there's a permanentness to them. And I think real-time information, we're used to getting it on our phone and we trust our phone. So there's an element of trust around digital signs. I also think there is a real issue with the age of things and how quickly they look out of date. And if you haven't housed them in something that's kind of, you know, timeless, and so often that they, you know, they malfunction.
Yes.
And then, you know, it's, I mean, even if you go into a museum, how often do you see, you know, the digital interactive is out of order? And, you know, I think there's the point at which, for the amount it gets used, you know, quite often it just isn't robust enough. And also digital signs tend to be for one person. So they're not nearly as effective as, I mean, if I took a directory in a retail space, which is interactive and you're trying to find, you know, you choose where you want to go, that only allows for one person. Whereas if you've got a static directory, you know, multiple people can be accessing that information at the same time.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've literally seen in a big shopping center in Berlin years back, where there was a digital screen, interactive digital directory, and there was one person standing there. Of course, no one's going to queue up for that directory. And then the other side of the mall, they had just traditional static wayfinding. There was about 30, 40 people looking at those and just making their way around the shopping center, which at that point to me seemed much more effective than someone, you know, waiting in line trying to get your way around the place.
Yeah, I think digital's obviously moving, you know, daily, and it'll be interesting to see if this really is us waking back up again and things moving, what changes there will be to our day-to-day. I don't think we can't really understand what that's going to be like yet. And I think, you know, in every project I've done over the last 20 years, digital has definitely been a factor. And it, like everything else, it's interrogated as to whether it really is the right thing to do. And if it is, what it's really trying to achieve. And, you know, is the content management and all the back end stuff actually in place? And is there a person who's going to keep it, you know, up to date? All, it's very practical, actually. And most of the time, it gets factored out, because the reality is, from a cost point of view, from a management point of view, from a practical point of view, it just isn't right. And, you know, outside, digital doesn't really work because of the sun. And,
yes, yeah.
So a lot of it is about practical considerations, but it's always part of the discussion, definitely.
And they're talking about the COVID situation, who's ever going to be wanting to touch those digital screens after this, I wonder if that is really going to be the way we're going to be dealing with these, interacting with these things.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, it's slightly overwhelming to think about the changes that this has brought and will bring, and for how long. But I think there's also an exciting challenge. It's had, you know, it's made us have to reset. And I think there's always a positive out of something so tragic as this. And I think as designers, and particularly as designers who work in the built environment, we know we have an incredible opportunity and responsibility to keep doing what we were doing before, but make sure that, you know, the biggest thing at the moment is I think for me anyway, is changing people's fear. And I think a lot of people are fearful to go out to do very normal things that they never even thought of before. And the kind of area of design that I work in, we have an incredible opportunity to help make that a positive experience by the language that we use, the wayfinding that we introduced. You know, everything has suddenly been about you can't do this and you can't do that and stand here and don't go too close. And yes, of course, those things are absolutely right and are important, but there's a way of getting that information over that doesn't necessarily have to be all about the negative and the kind of the rules. So it will be interesting as things are starting to definitely this week shift. You know, we've got to work together to hope and help people feel safe again.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's a lovely way to end this conversation as well. I'm hoping that it will be much more than red tape saying, you can't, don't move, stand back, don't enter. You know, the fear is definitely something that we will have to deal with. Thank you very much, Lucy. This has been really really wonderful. I feel like we could have continued for a while.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This podcast is created by me, Antonio Pavlovich, and produced in my closet. The music is by Mighty. If you find this podcast interesting, you can support it by sharing it on your social media. That will be of tremendous help. Thank you.